Welcome to Soul Path Parenting, the podcast that explores how we set our kids up to live their best lives from the start, and how we stay conscious, inspired, and sane while we do it. I'm your host, Amy Breeze Cooper.
I'm quite certain that that's the reality that Jesus perceived and knew himself to be part of, and knew that we all are part of. There is no separateness. So Jesus is not separate from any of us. Like, it's one, we are one thing. And he knew that, and he tried to convey that to people. And yet, over time, that became projected onto him, something that is inherent to all of us. It is our true nature, became projected onto him. And so he was set apart on a pedestal, like the special human being. And by doing that, by projecting our own divine nature onto him solely, we have alienated ourselves from our true selves.
Have you ever had one of those conversations where someone puts words to something that you had always intuitively known to be true, but had never heard it articulated? Well, this conversation had many of those for me, and I'm so excited to share it with you. Our guest today on episode 28 is Patricia Pierce, and she is an author and a spiritual teacher. She's going to share with us her personal journey from having spent 17 years as a Presbyterian pastor, having a spiritual awakening, and really shifting her life into a commitment to teaching people that we are not separate from one another, that we're really all interconnected. She's going to share with us her interpretation of what's happening in the world today and why it's here as an opportunity for us. She's going to talk about the coronavirus, but also what she calls the coronavirus of the mind. And she's going to share with us what we can learn from our children and from nature. This is a masterclass, you guys. There is so much packed into this hour, and I hope it profoundly impacts you as much as it has me. Welcome, Patricia, and thank you so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure.
So, in your memoir, Beyond Jesus, you gave a beautiful account of your spiritual odyssey. And I know we can't boil that down into a couple of minutes, but could you give listeners a sense of your path?
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in a very mainstream Presbyterian church in Denver. My family was Presbyterian. My father's roots were Scottish, which is how we ended up being Presbyterian. And, you know, we went to church every week, and I went to Sunday school, and I went to vacation Bible school, and I did all those things, sort of like, you know, the conventional Christian upbringing. And then, you know, I went through my phases, especially like in college. You know, I sort of moved away from all of that, and I think that's very typical. And then after college, I went into the Peace Corps, and I was in South America, in Ecuador, for a couple of years. And that was a very transformative experience for me, and especially seeing the economic inequalities really hit me. And I had some very interesting experiences while I was there that really planted the seeds for me to go into the ministry. And so when I came back to the States, I taught school for a while, ESL in Spanish, and then I went to seminary in California, and I was ordained as a Presbyterian minister and ministered for 17 some years in the Presbyterian Church. And the UCC, United Church of Christ. But it was after the death of a very close friend of mine, someone that I knew from seminary, and she really had been like a soul companion in a way. I mean, we'd gone through some very challenging times in our own spiritual journeys, and we'd sort of accompany mm-hmm. one another in that process. And she had an incurable disease called aplastic anemia, and she underwent a bone marrow transplant, and she ended up dying due to complications from that procedure. And her death really, really hit me. And there was something about, and I think this often happens, that grief, in a way, it opens a portal for us mm-hmm. to get real about our own lives. And there was something about her death that caused me to realize that there was some way in which I'd been living my life on the surface. Like there was some depth of my own existence that I had not yet realized. And I made this firm, like, inner resolve to know what that was. And that experience sort of led to a whole snowballing of events that ended up in this sort of confluence of all of these synchronicities and things that just came upon me all at once. This is over a year after she died, but it catapulted me into this spiritual awakening kind of experience where, and I, you know, I tell this whole story in my book, but I just had this experience where it was like, you know, if people are aware of like Kundalini awakenings, energy awakenings, it was that kind of an experience where the energy centers of my body really opened up in this very sort of spontaneous way. And it opened up my awareness, my consciousness, to the absolute realization that I was not and am not a separate self. Up until that point in my life, I'd always lived from this assumption, this perception of being a separate being, having my own individual life. And in this experience that I had this one afternoon in July in 2002, it's like the curtain was just ripped away from the world that I, as I had perceived it. And I saw, it's very hard to describe this, but I saw the fundamental interconnectedness of all that is. And I saw and recognized that I, as a separate self, didn't exist. That there, it simply doesn't exist. And I was in this heightened state of consciousness for several days and was sort of getting information downloaded about how we are living in a kind of a dream, a trance state, that this world is a sort of a trance state or a sort of a dream. And we're acting out, and we see it now on the global stage, we're acting out this story that is based in this erroneous idea that we are separate entities and that we're separate from the earth, we're separate from one another, we're separate from the source of our being. So that experience, of course, was profound, and it took my life in a very different direction. And I struggled, I was still serving as a pastor at that time, and I really struggled to integrate this experience with the tradition that I had been raised in and that I also then was representing as a clergy person. And I came to also see how, my shorthand jargon now to talk about that is that the ego mind is the aspect of mind that perceives things through this lens of separateness. And that idea gives rise to this false self, this isolated separate self. And I could see then how the Christian tradition had looked at the teachings of Jesus and the life of Jesus through that same lens of separateness. Mm-hmm. And so that egoic idea of separateness became interwoven into the religious belief system. So, you know, that was a long process of me trying to integrate that experience and hold together that experience with my vocation as a clergy person and trying to reconcile them. And I worked at that for many years, trying to reconcile them. And finally, I ended up leaving my position as a pastor in 2010 and have since embarked on writing and speaking and teaching and some other things.
Wonderful. One of the things you wrote in the book, and it's actually the very first sentence, has been echoing in my mind so much since the moment that I read it. And I just wanted to share it with our listeners and ask you to expand a little bit on this idea. Jesus has become an obstacle to our spiritual evolution, not because of who he was, but because of who we have made him out to be. Mm-hmm. I get goosebumps saying that because it just so profoundly resonates with me. And I wonder if you could just expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in that experience that I had, that awakening experience where I saw so clearly that there is no such thing as separateness, that interconnectedness is the reality in which we all abide. And I believe that that was, well, I'm quite certain that that's the reality that Jesus perceived and knew himself to be part of and knew that we all are part of. There is no separateness. So Jesus is not separate from any of us. Like it's one, we are one thing. And he knew that. And he tried to convey that to people. And yet, over time, that, you know, we can talk about it as Christ consciousness or unitive consciousness, became projected onto him, something that is inherent to all of us. It is our true nature, became projected onto him. And so he was set apart on a pedestal, like the special human being. And by doing that, by projecting our own divine nature onto him solely, we have alienated ourselves from our true selves. And in fact, it even has gone to the extent that it's heretical to say anything different, to say that, you know, we're all part of this thing. And so that really is, you know, over time, that belief system has become an obstacle to us coming into a full awareness of who we truly are as one with reality, one with the, you know, the realm of love.
Right. And so it seems to me really you're walking the path of wisdom teacher in many ways. And it feels like many people are starting to awaken to these ideas that you're sharing. How do you, what words would you have for someone who's hearing this? Many people are already down the path that are probably listening to this podcast, but for some people, the ideas that you're sharing may be new. How do they sort of start to walk down that path or explore these ideas?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think for each person, it's very personal. And I think that if we look closely, our lives are our own teachers and that we're each given our own curriculum on this planet that is perfect for the things that we need to learn in this lifetime. So for me, it begins with looking deeply into our own lives and our own experience. That wisdom will never be found outside of ourselves because it's inside of ourselves. That's the whole point. And so, you know, I would say that to really take seriously your own journey and your own the wisdom that is within you, and to really begin to delve into that. And of course, over my lifetime, I've done a lot of things to cultivate that inner life. I've journaled and meditated, and you know all the things that we do. Dream work has been huge, as you know, having read my book. Paying attention to our dreams, that is an amazing portal of wisdom for us. Like every night we get teachings every night. And so that is an amazing portal where our dreams come to us with unique messages that are designed for us. Now, sometimes we have dreams that have resonance for the whole, like global, you know, with global implications. But for me, it's, and of course, you know, reading the insights of others is helpful, but ultimately we are on our own path, and the wisdom lies within us.
You know, I'm glad that you brought up dreams as a portal for understanding, because I wanted to actually ask you to talk more about that. Through reading your book, I got more of a picture of how these messages can really come through. And I haven't used it as a foundation for insight per se. And you have just done so beautifully. And I imagine there are other listeners out there who have these vivid dreams that they then have memories of when they awaken. And I'm just would love for you to share a little bit more of your experience with interpreting those.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got into that when I was in seminary, because I started having these really significant dreams that I knew were important and I needed to understand them. And I'll just share one that I share in my book as well, but I think it applies to what we're talking about here, where in this dream, I'm in the seminary library. And in the dream, not in waking life, but in the dream, the library is like a garden level room. So there are windows up towards the ceiling, which is, you know, the windows are at ground level. So this sort of sunken right beneath a little lower than the first floor would be. So I'm in the seminary library and I'm studying. And all of a sudden, there's this tremendous earthquake that starts. Now, mind you, I was in seminary in the Bay Area, and this was just months after a very big earthquake hit the Bay Area, which I lived through, so I knew what earthquakes could be. And so in this dream, I'm studying in the seminary library, and this huge earthquake starts to hit, and the building starts to shake, and, you know, the building starts to collapse, and outside the windows up towards the ceiling, there are these vines that were growing outside. They start to grow at this explosive rate, and they shatter the windows and they start to fill the library. And I know I have got to get out of there or I will die. And so I manage to run up the stairs and I get outside and I'm in this courtyard area. And I see this small child, an infant, there with a live butterfly in its mouth. And that dream was so potent. And so I was having dreams like that. And it's like, I've got to start figuring out what these are telling me. So I started studying dream work. And there's an excellent book that I would recommend to your readers, the first book that I ever read on the subject was called Inner Work by Robert Johnson. And it talks about dream work and active imagination and ritual. And that book really launched me into being able to unpack my dreams. And then I was really fortunate to be studying in a seminary that's part of a consortium of seminaries where there was a man who taught dream work who was world renowned. And so I took a dream work class with him. So it really stemmed from my seminary experience. But anyway, so that dream of the earthquake, just to sort of unpack that a little bit, I came to understand that the seminary library symbolizes this collected, wisdom, sort of in quotation marks, of all of these centuries of understanding, these theological understandings that are housed in this library. And I'm in the library and I'm studying these books, right? Which is a vicarious understanding. That's not what the spiritual life is about. It's not about studying other people's experiences. It's about opening up to your own experience. So, you know, I'm there, I'm studying what other people have thought about what the divine is. And this earthquake, like this cosmic force, forces me out. Like, I have to leave this library or I will die. Like, there's a way in which my own spirit will die if I stay here. Like, this is not my place. And the vines, you know, there are all kinds of, you know, metaphors of the vine. I mean, there's even a gospel passage, you know, where Jesus says, I am the vine. So there's this cosmic living force that's invading this constructed building that houses these understandings of the divine that were not mine. And I had to leave that, and I had to embark on my own journey of discovery.
One of the things that I observe that you've done so powerfully, there's a few things, but in your journey has not been an easy one, because you've broken with convention and there's a lot that you've had to let go of. And I do think that's one of the most powerful things that we as humans must do, is sometimes let go so that we can open up to more. And I'm wondering if you have thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's huge, really. Because we're all born into this world given a certain identity, if you will. We're given an identity from our families of origin. We're given an identity from our culture, in my case, from my religion. So I came into this world essentially being told who I was and who I should be.
Mm-hmm.
And we can spend our whole lives living out of that inherited identity. And oftentimes not even know the difference, like not even know that that's not authentically who we are. And in order to come to the awareness of who we truly are, we have to be willing to let that go. We have to be willing to let go of some of the, and sometimes it's hard. I mean, with this book that I wrote, this memoir, you know, that was not an easy thing to do, because I was really concerned that I might be offending people who were dear to me.
Yeah.
You know, family members, people who have known me since I was a child, people who sponsored me in seminary and stuff. And I was worried about it. And yet I knew that I needed to do it. So it's hard. It is hard to let go of those things. And I really do believe that we can't come into the fullness of who we are unless we're willing to do that. And you're right. It's rarely easy.
Yeah. The biggest breakthroughs in my life have been after I've let go of the thing I was afraid to let go of. So I just, yes. I think you're such a powerful example of that. I mean, to have been an ordained clergy person in a Christian church, and then to step into something else that called you, takes, I think, a lot of courage. And
yeah, and oftentimes the roles that we are in provide us a certain amount of security, and even more than security, again, like an identity. When I left the church, I didn't. I knew that I needed to leave. Again, dreams were coming, and it was just clear that it was time for me to leave. And I had no idea what I was in for when I left, because I was letting go of my vocation. I was walking away from my vocation, my career, my security. I mean, I, in a sense, as a, you know, an income, benefits.
Mm-hmm.
I had a place in society. I could tell people, like, this is what I do. And they understood, you know, oh, that's what she does. I had a spiritual community, my congregation, which I loved. And all of that I had to walk away from. And it was agonizing. I mean, there were times I went into a very, very hard place. And And all of those concerns, actually, when you look at it, they're all the ego. They're all ego. All that, that desire for security, that desire for some sort of social standing, you know, all of that, though, all those egoic needs, my ego was like freaking out. Mm-hmm. And that's the process, right? Because it is this death kind of experience that part of the self or those concerns need to die away if we're going to become free of them, if we're really going to step into the fullness of who we are.
Right.
Because as long as we're living from those fears, we can never be free people.
It's such a great segue into the next part of the conversation I wanted to bring in, because you've also talked about this dying away of one consciousness and stepping into a new consciousness at more of a global level for humanity, and particularly in the context of what's happening today with COVID and with what we're seeing in politics and in the environment. I would love if you could just share with our listeners what you're seeing happening in the world and how you're interpreting it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yes. Well, you know, for millennia, we've been living out of this assumption of our separateness. And we've been living out of that egoic mind, that egoic consciousness, perceiving ourselves to be separate. And look at where it's brought us. Look at what we have done to the planet, living out that story of separateness, how we have devastated the planet. And that story in our mind of being separate is unsustainable. It's simply unsustainable. And it's taken us now to a point of crisis where either we will choose to hold on to that story of separateness, and in which case it's like we're choosing a dead-end path, or we do this deep work of transformation that I believe begins within each of us, of letting go of that idea of the separate self, and allowing a new world to arise, one that reflects the reality of our interconnectedness. That's the only future. If we want to continue as a species, that is the only future for us. And so this deep inner transformation that we do is not only for our personal benefit, but it is the planetary transformation that's required right now. So we are on this cusp in this moment. We're alive on this planet in this incredible moment where this old idea that we have constructed a whole world around. And if you look at our economic system and our political systems, all of that reflects what we have held to be true in our minds. So we have an economic system that does not honor the truth of our interconnectedness. And right now we are seeing that so vividly with the pandemic. We are seeing that we need each other in ways that our economic system has not reflected or honored, and that has to change. So we're in this incredible moment right now of transition, a crisis. And I was interested to learn that the word crisis, I mean, we've all heard the Chinese characters for crisis or dangerous opportunity. But the word crisis in English comes from the Greek, and it means decision. A crisis is a moment of decision. And I was really interested to learn that the first time that the word crisis was used in English, it was a medical term. And it referred to the point in a disease where the status quo is no longer going to hold. The disease was either going to get worse and lead to death, or it was going to turn towards recovery. So the crisis moment is that turning point. And wow, can we relate to that right now with this pandemic? So we are in a global crisis where this is what's at stake now. Will we choose the path of recovery? Will we choose the path that of creating a world that reflects the truth of love? Or will we try to hold on to an old story that has no future for us? And we see that playing out. We see it playing out in real time. It's extraordinary to be alive right now. And I see it in the present administration. Now, I do dream work on what's happening in the political realm as well. And if we look at this symbolically, Donald Trump is a symbol of that egoic mind that has lived within all of us. And he is actually doing us a tremendous service if we're willing to pay attention, because he is revealing to us what that egoic mind looks like, what its priorities are, what it fears, what it longs for, what it craves. And he is putting it on full display so that we can each make our own choice. Is that the mindset that we want to live out of? And, you know, and that mindset, that egoic mindset, is always about blame. It's always about making others. Mm-hmm. It's about having enemies. It's about attacking. And so we see that playing out right now. And if we are willing to really be brave and look closely, we will see that in our own thinking. And perhaps we see it when we think of Donald Trump.
Right.
Maybe we see him as the enemy. And if we're seeing him as the enemy, we are engaging that same egoic mind.
Right.
And that is the radical transformation. That's what love is. Love is, love cannot be separated. Like there is, love is indivisible. Love is the reality of all that is. It is the reality of interconnectedness. That's what love is. And nothing can be outside of love. It just isn't possible. We pretend that it is in our own minds. We have this illusion playing in our own minds that we are separate or that we can be isolated from love or cast out of love, but we can't. And so that is the radical move now that we are being invited into, to absolutely let go of that whole idea of the other, that whole idea of the enemy, and to recognize that there is not anything that can exist outside of the realm of love. No person, no being, nothing can exist outside of it.
It's so powerful. And, you know, I even caught myself having those thoughts yesterday, because here in Denver, we had protests against the stay-at-home orders and then counter-protests by many people in the medical field against the protests. And I found myself in a place of judgment. How could you protest the stay-at-home order? We all must join together so that we can protect those who are the most at risk. And then I caught myself, oh, there's a judgment. And I loved in the book how you talked about violence can't be the solution to violence. And it's so true here too. Like, as we think about people who may have different points of view than we do, just separating ourselves from them and creating them as the enemy doesn't serve.
Right. It just perpetuates the same story.
Yeah.
I held an online gathering a while ago where I was actually doing dream work with this pandemic and parsing, for instance, parsing the word coronavirus. And corona, of course, is the Latin word for crown. And if you parse that, you know, what is a crown? But the symbol of the monarch, like the one who's set apart and special and with all of the power, right? So that, so you can see the crown as emblematic, or the supreme symbol of an egoic orientation, of a hierarchical social structure. And yet this virus is showing us the opposite. It's showing us that we are all truly in it together. But it's not just the physical coronavirus, but the coronavirus of the mind. And that's what I'm most interested in, because that's the sort of the pathogen of the mind that is doing much more devastation, if we really look at it, than the virus that affects the body and the respiratory system. So it's that whole idea of letting go of judgment. If I understand that the egoic mind is sort of like a pathogen in the mind, and mm-hmm. we all are carriers of it, let's not delude ourselves. We all have been born into this sort of pathological mindset. So we are all carriers of it. And so when I look at, say, the protesters who are, you know, doing this, you know, protesting the stay-at-home orders, if I can look at them as, oh, that's that story that's playing out in the mind. And it's like not just them, it's like all of us. It's just another manifestation. So if we can look at all of this as sort of like dream figures that are coming to us to help us awaken, to help us let go of that, those patterns in our own mind. Let me say that Jeremy Taylor is the person that I studied dream work with in seminary. And he would always say, all dreams come in the interest of health and wholeness. Mm. All dreams, even nightmares. And he would say, nightmares are nightmares because the information that they are bringing us is so important that they will scare us to wake us up to it. And I see us right now as in a nightmare, a collective nightmare. And that's because it's bringing us this critically important information,
yeah,
for us to see and acknowledge and integrate.
I loved, and I did listen, you have a podcast called The Evolutionary Activist, and I listened to the episode on the coronavirus of the mind. I wondered if you could also share how you parsed apart COVID. I thought that was very fascinating.
I just like playing, because dreams, you know, nighttime dreams often play with words. Word plays are, at least in my dreams, are very, very common. And so I was curious by this name, COVID. What an interesting name. And of course, it's an acronym. The term is an acronym. But if it were a word, it would literally mean to see together, because co means together. And vid is the Latin word, which means to see.
Right.
Just like a video is, you know, video is to see. So the word COVID means to see together. And the word pandemic means all people. So we are in this moment where all people are seeing something together. And what we're seeing together is the unavoidable reality of our interconnectedness. So that, you know, if we're willing to really look at it and to even let go of the idea of enemy when it comes to the virus. I mean, I'm seeing this emerge more and more, you know, talking of this as we're in a war or we're in a battle. So you can see how the mind continues to engage this battle and enemy kind of narrative. And yet, if we look more deeply, we can see there's way more to the story. Like this, if we're willing to look at this as a teaching, a wisdom teaching for our time, showing us all together the truth of our interconnectedness, then we can be in relationship with this global phenomenon very, very, very differently, and in relationship with this virus very differently.
I just love sharing that perspective, because it does feel like it's a challenge right now. There's so much struggle happening around this. And I want to believe that, and I do believe that this is a catalyst for something better on the other side of it. So Thank you for that.
Yeah. And I really see it as I look at it as really humanity's initiation. We're in an initiatory process. which, you know, in shamanic cultures, people undergo initiations, or in many indigenous cultures, young people undergo initiations to transition into adulthood. And those initiations often involve great, great challenges. And they involve the letting go of the former self.
Mm.
And I really see that humanity right now is in an initiatory process, that the earth, I mean, I really see us, this is not just the human story, this is Earth's story. We are expressions of the earth, and Mother Earth, I believe, is initiating her children, her human children. We are in this process of moving into our adulthood as a species, where we can be in relationship, in right relationship with all of life on this planet. And initiations always involve confronting one's fears. And they involve what happens in a chrysalis.
Mm-hmm.
When a caterpillar moves into the chrysalis stage. And I believe that we are in our chrysalis right now. And people who've studied this, biologists who've studied what happens in the chrysalis, the caterpillar, of course, is a creature that consumes voraciously. You know, it eats up a whole, you know, parsley plant in a day. So it engorges itself, and then eventually it moves into this next stage where it hangs itself upside down. And symbolically, hanging upside down in the tarot deck, there's a card called the Hanged One, of a person hanging upside down. And it is a symbol of the initiation and of the surrender. So the caterpillar hangs itself upside down when it goes into the chrysalis stage. And in that chrysalis, it undergoes a process of dissolution. And the creature itself dissolves, and the structures of its body dissolve into a soup. And in that soup is the DNA, the information, the code to bring forth a new creature. And those cells, they're called organizer cells, they begin to find each other and connect with each other, and they begin to form the organs of the new creature, of the butterfly. But one of the things that I find really interesting is, in that process, when those organizer cells are beginning to connect and form the new creature, there's enough of the immune system of the caterpillar still intact that it will attack these organizer cells, believing that what is coming forth is an enemy.
Really?
Yes. So it attacks the emerging organs of the butterfly, believing that what it is an alien force, an enemy. And we see that right now. That's what's happening. There is this global consciousness that is emerging, and there is this still somewhat active immune system of the old story that is attacking this thing that's emerging, believing that it is a dire threat, believing that it is an enemy, not recognizing that what it actually is the full expression of the same creature, the same life force. So in the chrysalis, there's this thing that's happening. There's this dissolution, and then this beginning of these organizer cells finding each other and forming what are called, I can't remember the exact term, that become the new creature, the butterfly. And eventually, so this immune system attack is happening, but the organizer cells don't attack back. They just keep organizing.
Mm.
They just keep finding each other. They keep connecting. They keep forming the new organs of the new creature. And eventually, they simply overwhelm this immune system that's dying away, and the butterfly comes into existence. And I see that that's what's happening right now. And so those of us who are on the planet right now who want to participate in this emergence, in this, what Joanna Macy calls the great turning, this global awakening, those of us who want to assist in that, our task is not to attack the attackers. Mm-hmm. They're just playing out an old story. They're simply playing out the programming of the story that's passing away. That's all they're doing. It's just an old program. So it's not about attacking or even trying to stop or thwart the attackers, but to continue to organize, to continue to find each other, to continue to build the new world, the new expression of humanity that wants to come forth.
Right.
So seeing it through that lens, I think, helps us to not get sucked into that old narrative, because that's the dead-end narrative, that narrative of us and them. That's the narrative that has no future. And we don't have to try to solve it. We don't have to try to resist it. We just have to walk away from it and do what needs to be done right now.
I love that. That's so powerful. And what a metaphor for what's happening in humanity right now. One question that comes to mind is there are many people looking for a new way of raising our children in this conversation, which is really part of the inspiration of this podcast. And I had shared with you as we prepared for this interview, you know, I'm on a personal journey and sharing that with my listeners of really discovering how to bring children up with some spiritual connection. But many of us either don't have a faith or have more of a cultural faith tradition that's not necessarily a spiritual tradition. And so I had shared with you that there's no Sunday school for Eckhart Tolle. Right. And I'm just curious if you have thoughts on this conversation that we're having, how we bring our children up in that conversation.
Yes. Well, children have an innate capacity for wonder, which is, and playfulness and joy, which is, I believe, core to what spirituality is all about. Children have a much easier time actually connecting with the reality of oneness than adults do. So in a sense, we might ask, how can the children teach us what it is to be spiritual creatures on this planet? Spiritual beings on this planet. And also to be aware that, so I know someone, I mentioned this in our earlier conversation, that I know someone who has spent a very long time, like decades of his life, around this very, very question. And how can children be raised in this world free from the symbolic order of the past? Because the symbolic order, which includes the language that we use and how we use language, it includes our conceptions, our belief systems, our doctrines, all of that, it forms this symbolic order. And children then are placed within this symbolic order in which to grow. And he uses this great metaphor. He talks about it as, imagine there was a pumpkin vine. And there's a small pumpkin, like a flower, you know, of the pumpkin that is going to grow into a fruit. And you take that flower and you insert it into a 1 gallon jug. So you insert that new emerging pumpkin into this 1 gallon jug. And as it grows, it will grow into the shape of that jug. So you end up with a jug-shaped pumpkin. And he likens that to what happens to the child's brain that is placed within the symbolic order of the past that constrains its ability to live into the fullness of what it is meant to be. So I believe that I'm not a parent, and I so respect people who are parenting in this particular moment, because it is a great calling, I believe, to raise children to allow them to continue to live in that sense of wonder and discovery of what it means to be alive on this amazing planet. And what is the earth teaching us about our interconnectedness with all of life? And to not constrain the child's understanding with ideas or doctrines that have come out of that dying idea of separateness. So to not implant in that young mind the idea of them being separate from the source of existence.
Right.
So really to as much as possible to be mindful of how is that old symbolic order showing up? And how might we then simply choose not to raise children within that pumpkin jug?
Right.
And to let them be on the path of their discovery, because they have within themselves everything that they need to know if they are allowed to discover it. With, you know, a little bit of guidance here and there. But generally, I think that the children coming onto the planet right now, Buckminster Fuller once said, your children are your, in a sense, your elders, because they are farther along on the evolutionary path. They are the expression of a more evolved humanity. And so to honor the wonder of the child,
mm-hmm.
and to allow that playful and joyful and creative spirit to flourish. There have been studies done where children have been tested for creativity, and young children test very high, like 94% of young children test as creative geniuses. And then over the course of time, as kids enter sort of the regular school establishment and are acculturated, over time, that number drops and drops and drops until we get to adulthood, and it's sort of inverse. It's like 9% of adults test as creative geniuses. So we lose, that creative genius is trained out of us. So I think as parents, one thing that is really important is to allow that creative genius that is within the child to thrive.
Right.
And that sense of discovery and exploration and playfulness. I believe that that really is core to our survival as a species. I mean, hello.
Yeah.
We need to be as creative as we can possibly be.
I love everything that you're saying, and it really resonates with the notions around conscious parenting and that they come in conscious. It's up to us not to put our unconsciousness upon them in a way that disconnects them. And another avenue, it feels to me, that I would love for you to talk a little bit about is just connection with nature, which children seem to have such a natural propensity for. And then we sort of somehow, as we grow up, seem to cut ourselves off more. And your notion of oneness, I just love, if you recall from the book where you talked about putting halos, not just on Mary, Joseph, and Jesus. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Yeah, sure. Yeah. This was after I'd left my position in the church, and I was attending a concert at a church in Center City, Philadelphia. And behind the chancel, they have this big mural of the nativity scene. And of course, Mary and Joseph and Jesus are front and center, and they all have halos. And I think can't remember now if the wise men were there who would have had halos, but the shepherds, the animals, they didn't have halos. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, that's the problem right there. We train ourselves and we communicate this idea that some are more holy than others, that some are more sacred than others. So I imagined artists going into all the churches and painting halos on everything, halos on the donkeys, halos on the cow, halos on the trees, on the land. Like, then the iconography would be useful for us, in our own understanding. It's like, oh, wow. Oh, yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. That robin has a halo. Check that out.
Yeah.
Wow. That grasshopper. Can you see that grasshopper's halo? Oh my God. gosh. You know, so then we would, then the iconography would actually serve this awakening rather than distancing us and setting us into that idea of specialness.
Right. You know, I was separate. Just delighted by the conjuring up the image of this sort of crew of people with paintbrushes going out into all the churches and bringing that sort of source energy to, in a very practical, tangible way, to all the beings of the earth. And maybe one day that will happen. I would just love that. And I think it's a way that our kids naturally connect. They know that they're connected. And when they are connected, it's often with so much presence in the now. And then we snap them out of it because it's time for dinner or whatever. So,
exactly. And we put them in school rooms with fluorescent lights and linoleum floors and try to inculcate within them the, quote, wisdom that we have to offer them. What would it be if the children had an opportunity to teach us what they know?
Indeed.
What they instinctively know.
Yeah. I have a couple more questions for you. And one of them is the question that really inspired this podcast. My daughter, when she was 3, asked me, "Mommy, what's going to happen to me when I die?" And because I was in a very different place spiritually than necessarily the context I was raised in, I didn't have a clear answer, and I wanted to talk to other people who and learn what their answers to that question would be. So maybe for a broader age of child, but how would you answer that question?
Of what happens after we die?
What's going to happen to me when I die? Yeah.
Well, what I believe based on, okay, so let me back up and say that, for instance, my friend Tricia, after she died, there were times when she was extremely present. And so, you know, I have experienced the presence of people who are no longer embodied. So I have absolutely no doubt that there is something of us that endures, and that we all are, you know, and we know now that everything that we see is energy, and matter is energy. It's just frozen energy. It's, condensed energy. Our bodies are condensed energy, and you can't kill energy. Energy just changes state. It can't be killed. So we change form, and energy is constantly coming into different patterns of form, different shapes and expressions, and then, you know, dissipating and taking on a different kind of a form. So I absolutely believe that there is some essence of us that endures, and there are aspects of who we are that do not endure. Like, you know, when my body is gone, my body returns to the earth, the substance of my body, and continues to participate in the cycle of life, which is a beautiful thing. And the personality, I believe that the personality, certainly that false self, that egoic self, by the way, the self that's worried about death, is the part that actually doesn't endure. That's the part that doesn't continue. But the essence of who we are, I believe, does continue, because we are all part of this. We are all dancing together in this cosmic realm of existence. And I really do believe that we continue on in some fashion. Now, I've never had a near-death experience. People who have certainly have things to say about that, and that it is when we die, we experience the absolute nature of love and have some perspective on how we were worried about things that we didn't need to be worried about, and how much of our lives we spent living out of fear. So, yeah, I mean, we're all going to find out, right? But we're all going to find out one way or another in someday. But it's interesting because after that, you know, that awakening experience, and I just knew that everything is one. Nothing ceases to exist. Everything continues to participate in this cosmic connectedness. I'm not afraid of death. I mean, it feels sort of like a grand adventure. Mm-hmm. Now, the dying process may not be so enjoyable, but death itself, I think, will be a grand adventure. Much like birth, you know, we go through a birth canal into a world that we could never have imagined from inside the womb.
Right. Well said. My last question for you is this. This podcast, most of our listeners are parents or grandparents, and I wonder, if you had one wish for parents, what would it be?
Be gentle with yourself. That's the first thing. That's what my heart wants to say. Be gentle with yourself. And the gentler you are with yourselves, the gentler you'll be with your children. And, you know, this whole idea of dropping judgment, it starts with ourselves and to letting go of judging ourselves. And so it might seem a little bit odd to say, you know, in terms of parenting, be compassionate to yourself. And if you're compassionate to yourself, you'll be compassionate with your children.
So beautifully said. Thank you so much, Patricia, for sharing your wisdom. It's been wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Amy.
As we conclude this episode, and if you've listened before, you know that we like to leave with a nugget of inspiration that you can apply in your own life, because it really is taking action that makes the difference. And in this case, this is a big one, you guys. I really invite you to consider and answer the call. This notion that Patricia talked about of letting go of the idea of our separateness and doing this deep inner work that starts inside of each of us, that's really part of a planetary transformation that we're just on the cusp of. That's my invitation to you. No big deal. Nothing big. I kid, and yet I do actually think that our first steps into this can start in small ways. So maybe you're already on this path. Maybe you're already doing these things. And if you're not, here are some ideas to consider. Journaling, which Patricia talked about, or dream work, interpreting your dreams. Because we are connected and we are getting messages. You can go for a walk with nature. Of course, we've talked about it many times on this podcast, but meditation is fundamental. And prayer. There's many ways of kind of tapping into your inner wisdom. And I do believe that it's by connecting with ourselves that we begin to experience the interconnectedness that we have with everything and everyone. So consider that. And if you're moved, take some action on that in your life. Thank you so much for listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please share this with someone else or subscribe so that we can continue the conversation with you again next week. Thanks so much.